that we're actually an author company. We're at an author company.
You haven't just hired someone to just pretend to work.
No. Yeah. We're getting all the greatest mezzo hits, though. I think she must be doing a mezzo-soprano audition somewhere. Good afternoon, everyone. This is Gianmarco Segato. I'm the Adult Programs Manager at the COC, the Canadian Opera Company, and I'm welcoming you to episode 12 of the Big COC podcast. And today I have three returning guests. Really happy to have everyone here this afternoon. First, John Jilks. Hi, John. How are you doing?
Hi. Fine, thanks.
Good. John is most well known to the opera reading audience for his blog, Opera Ramblings, which you can Google. And again, I'm always so impressed by how quickly you get your reviews up. I mean, you were at a concert, what, this afternoon, was it? And within a couple hours, there was a great review for us to read.
Yeah, that's what happens when you have half an hour between meetings.
Also welcoming back Joseph So. Hello, Joseph.
Great to be back.
Good. Joseph is Professor Emeritus, as I've said before, from Trent University. But he writes on opera for Opera Canada, La Scena Musicale, and the British magazine called, funnily enough, Opera. And for the second time, Aaliyah Rosenstock is back. Hey, Aaliyah, how are you doing?
Hi, great.
And she's an associate artist manager with Dean Artist Management. It's an artist management firm based in Toronto and New York, which represents some of Canada's finest musicians. So, I thought we'd start off today, since we last recorded, there have been a spate of opera awards, and who even knew these opera awards existed? In fact, the first one we're going to talk about didn't exist before this year. It's called the Opera Awards, and it's put on by Opera Magazine, and it sort of came out of nowhere. They had, like most of these kind of things do, they had a number of nominees in various categories, and they announced the winners about a week ago. So, for example, this is one of the more curious categories because it's accessibility. And when I first read that, I thought it had to do with
wheelchairs.
Yeah, you know, which is great. But yeah. The Metropolitan Opera won that award, and I'm assuming that was...
It wasn't for the ticket prices.
Well, I never actually could figure... I couldn't... There was nothing on the website to... click on. Like,
right,
I still
right.
don't really understand.
I could assume it was for the HDs.
I think so.
Just
yeah.
broadening
Although
the audience.
Why,
yeah.
Okay.
Why that rather than, you know, say, Bayerischer Staatsoper streaming stuff free, which is even more accessible.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. You know, this is what's a bit curious and we can talk about
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
So I won't go through all of them, but the conductor of the year for Opera One, who won, was Antonio Papano, who was course center of one of our former discussions.
Yeah.
He's Covent Garden, the music director there. Let's see, the female singer was Nina Stemme. The festival was the Salzburg Festival.
It's
like Lifetime Achievement was Sir George Christie, who I guess is he's a member of the Christie family who started Glyndebourne, is that
he owns,
right?
He owns Glyndebourne.
Oh, okay.
He's the current baronet,
wow.
I think.
Yeah, there was
as opposed to Danny Denise's husband, who'll be the next baronet.
Right, right.
Then she'll be Lady Denise, I think about that. Oh, Lady Christie.
Oh, wow.
I wonder if she'll go as nuts as Lady Hall did.
Do you mean, like, will she do, sing, play Zalame and...
Well, there's something to cut you with.
Okay.
William Christie is not part of this.
No,
right?
No.
He's
American.
American.
He's American. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. A different Christie.
From Buffalo.
And it's no relation to Anna Christie either.
Right, who's our current Lucia, yeah. doing an amazing job as Lucia here in Toronto. Male singer of the year was Jonas Kaufmann. And
well deserved.
Yeah.
And he won the audience, the Reader's Choice as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's an amazing singer. So, and the orchestra was the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra. Again, another one, like, they were all, everyone always says they're the greatest opera orchestra in the world. And then they win this award. So, what do you guys think about these opera awards? Are they something that the opera world desperately needed, or?
Well, it's for promotion,
what?
More than anything else, I would think.
Mm-hmm.
Really, you know. There's no monetary value associated with it. I don't
no.
think.
They do, it is a foundation, so it's a little different from, I think, a lot of different music award programs, in the sense that it does provide monetary some stipends or grants to up and coming artists. But I don't know if that was the actual part of the award system. Or if that's something completely separate. But
I'd kind of be interested in this if you could get the kind of buzz around it that you get around some of the literary prizes, like the Man Booker or something like that. But there was no sign of it. I mean, it's not like this made, you know, it might have made the inside back page of The Guardian or something. But there was no buzz outside the opera world. So it boiled down to a sort of insider's gathering of mutual backslapping, I think.
Gramophone is having a similar kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
So that's why I think maybe it could be sort of like keeping up with the Joneses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
This is Opera Magazine, which I write for.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had the sense that, yeah, they were trying to kind of create some kind of buzz, like you know, and so that opera has its set of awards, like the Grammys or the Oscars. I mean, obviously, it was not on that level.
They have to start getting designers to dress everybody on their way into the awards and broadcast it at around dinner time. And
right.
They'll start getting a following.
You know, you are not far off. There is a German award called Echo.
Mm-hmm.
Echo Award. And it's extremely glitzy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but there's an audience in Germany.
Yeah.
You know, that's
yeah,
the difference.
Yeah.
And the opera audience is just much bigger.
Well, there was another set of awards that recently came out, and these are, I think, much more well-established, the Opera News Awards, so a different opera magazine.
Yeah.
Now, what they do every year is they'll pick four or five either singers or directors, this sort of thing, and offer them these awards.
Yes.
And for instance, the list this year, I'll just read it because it's pretty short. Eric Owens, who's coming to the COC next season, great American bass. Don Upshaw, the soprano, British baritone, Simon Keenly side, the great Italian soprano Marella Freni, and countertenor David Daniels. So they were all honored in Opera News magazine with a profile, and they do this every year.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I guess my question about these ones all the time is, you know, how do you compare someone like Eric Owens, who's a great singer, but he's only in his early 40s, and you've got Marella Freni, who's had this like legendary career and recorded every role. They're all at such different levels.
I'll try to answer that. Because actually, Opera Canada Awards, the Ruby, started before Opera News Awards.
That's right.
It is true. You know? Yes, because
you get that straight
I was
here.
Involved in Opera Canada Awards. The first year was 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to remember. It was definitely Maureen Forrester because I interviewed her for the article. And it was to honor people like lifetime achievement sort of thing.
Right.
And then we decided to give it also to people who are in the prime of their career.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think we have started giving it to people at the beginning of their career yet.
No, we don't, yeah. But I mean, it's a different climate here, you know, it's a smaller community, and I think there are a lot of people that deserved to have awards because it's such a new award. You know, if it is only 13 years old, there are people that have had these long careers and they haven't gotten anything yet. So back end.
You're talking about the Opera News Awards.
The Opera Canada.
Oh, the Opera Canada Awards.
Because,
okay.
You know, it is young. It's young. So
right.
It's still quite
people,
young. Yeah.
A lot of people don't have.
So it's like playing, you have to play catch up a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then there have been in the past those young artists' encouragement awards, so hopefully we can continue that in the future. But
a lot depends on whether they're donors, I guess, to give them. Last year was Joe Finley, was one of the three recipients, and he was well deserved.
Anything to say, John?
No, I can't get excited by this kind of award. I just can't. I think maybe if they came up with, you know, the director who really ought to have directed at the Met who hasn't, or something like that.
The Unsung Hero Award.
Yeah.
Well, I can tell that.
Or the best opera company with an annual budget less than Peter Gelb's salary.
Okay, I see a future topic where we can just like make up our wish list of awards. Well, since that was fired us up so much, I think we'll just kind of go on to the next topic. Now, this is something that Joseph, you kind of brought up to me, and this idea of maybe we could discuss crossover opera or artists who cross over genres or who are called opera singers who may or may not be. And it just coincided with a post I saw on good old, what's his name? all stirring it up.
Bocelli?
Slip disc, yeah. Norman Lebrecht. And he showed a picture of Catherine Jenkins, the Welsh mezzo pop singer, whatever, and we'll discuss that, because she was competing in a marathon, but she was labeled as a mezzo-soprano. And then, you know, of course, we have this whole list of people. People like Josh Groban, Jackie Evancho, Catherine Jenkins, Paul Potts, Andrea Bocelli, to a certain extent. And for Canadian content, we have the tenors.
Yes.
And in Quebec, they have their Marc Hervieux, the tenor. And I guess my question is, what I'd really like your opinions on are, okay, we've got these singers. I mean, they are singers. They kind of label themselves as classical singers sometimes. A lot of the audience seems to think that they're opera singers, and they saw a lot of CDs and records. So,
and some of them are legit opera singers. They are. Marc Hervieux has had a respectable opera career. You know, Bocelli began singing. I saw his Voltaire in Detroit. Mind you couldn't hear him beyond the 10th or 15th row.
That's shocking. I think people would be shocked to hear that. Because, you know, when it's engineered in a studio or mic'd on a stage, it sounds monstrous.
Right.
So it's quite shocking, isn't it? So.
I mean, I think what gets me, and it does upset me a bit, is that in some places, and I think the UK is worse than Canada for this, the popular press picks up on these people, and it creates an overwhelming impression that that's what opera singers are.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is so horribly unfair on opera singers. You know? I don't know. I mean, I suppose in and of themselves, I have no problem with it. I mean, if people like listening to what they do and want to buy their records, well, that's fine. But to describe it as opera singing is, you know, stretching a point, I think. I think what is interesting is to think about some opera singers who really are crossover artists in the sense that they perform competently in other genres well. That's to me, that's much more interesting. I mean, you know, Chris Maltman is a pretty good folk singer. I don't know how many people knew that, but... Yeah.
He's a British baritone, right?
Yeah. And does Rehab still sing in a metal band?
We're talking about one of our ensemble mezzos who, has there's sort of incriminating photos of her. I joked about it with her. She's in a former life. What do you think about some of these people? I mean, and I have to be careful not to judge. Like, you know, like you're right. In their for what they're doing, it's great, and they have this great success. But I wonder about the audience getting confused, though.
Well, I don't think it's not really a problem, except for people that really love opera and want to see it publicized and sort of brought more to the forefront of popular culture. For those people, and I'm one of those people included, I do wish that there was more of a sort of a publicity push for honest to goodness opera albums or classical albums. So that we would be educating people about what sort of quote unquote, you know, straight opera is, or it doesn't even have to, you know, be that. It could be operetta, it could be, you know, Lieder, anything like that. But just sort of, I think it's just simply because it's not part of the discourse that people, I sort of did this test, actually. I went on iTunes and I searched Il Divo, and I saw, you know, they have 7 albums and blah, blah, blah. But then at the bottom, you know, there's sort of that recommendation part, right. And it says, other people also bought. And of course it was, you know, Sarah Brightman, Catherine Jenkins.
Charlotte Church,
you know, those kind of, that is sort of that light opera light, or I don't know what you want to call that. But then you look, and so you see what's being recommended or referred to someone who maybe heard on the radio about Paul Potts' Amazing Story, or they saw Catherine Jenkins in one of those beautiful, I think it's a watch ad or a diamond earring ad or something, you know, and so they're looking, and this is what's recommended to them.
Right.
When, you know, maybe something else could be recommended to them. And if you search opera on iTunes, then you get just all these compilation CDs, and the only one with a person who I saw that is actually, you know, regularly singing opera was Plácido Domingo, and it was his album with John Denver from 100 years ago. So I think that in itself sort of frames the you know, the way it's presented to the public. I mean,
I think young singers, I mean, because the classical market is really so small, one way of making it is to go, if and if you look great and you know, you have a nice voice and nice personality, then you go the crossover route. I think that commercial success has something to do with it.
Well,
financial.
And, there's a problem with that because it's a one-way street. Because the opera world gets snobby about that.
True.
I mean, classic Canadian example would be Rebecca Kane. I mean, you know, pretty decent operatic soprano, and you know,
Lulu.
She sang Lulu at COC and a few other things. She's in Vixen as well, I think. But you know, she then got this big, you know, label all over a musical theater. Never done opera again.
Do you feel? I feel like that's changing though, because I feel that because so many opera companies are producing, quote unquote, legit musical theater productions nowadays, that you're requiring the regular mainstream opera singer to have knowledge of musical theater repertoire to be able to switch between singing Puccini and then going back to Rodgers Hammerstein.
But you see, so I think that's because that kind of old-fashioned, for want of a better word, were unamplified, you know, 1940s and 50s musical theater has moved into the opera house. It's not on Broadway anymore.
Right.
You know, you're still not going to get the, you know, Chicago Lyric Opera doing Cats or Phantom of the Opera. But you know what I mean. You know, you're not going to see, and it is really only, I think, the big American houses who throw in one classic musical from when their audience was young to pad out their season.
But in Europe, it's very accepted. Broadway in Europe, West Side Stories, for example, almost all of the A houses like Vienna.
Yeah, but West Side Stories always been an anomaly. I mean, it was written by Bernstein, for heaven's sake.
And it's speaking with one of the producers that we work with a lot in Paris, he was saying that they only actually like the musical theater from the 50s, that they actually don't even know. We were laughing because he said, I'd say most people couldn't hum anything from Les Miserables to you. Like they would, I mean, I think that a lot of people in North America would be surprised to find that, you know, a musical based on Paris Uprising, you know, no one in Paris can name anybody or sing anything.
But you know, it's interesting. This happens with what, over time, with what was once the popular musical genre with which the opera house would not sully itself. You know, whether it's French operetta from the late 19th century or Gilbert and Sullivan or classic musicals from the 1940s, when they were fresh, they never got anywhere near a proper opera house. Now, you know, wait long enough and they get beefed up and brought into the repertoire. And you hear ENO doing Gilbert and Sullivan. It doesn't sound anything like D'Oyly Carte doing Gilbert and Sullivan. And the same thing with you know, when the French operetta rep goes into, you know, a legit French opera house and you have people like Nathalie Dessay and Yann Baron, people like that singing, it doesn't sound the same as it did when it was, quotes, operetta. It's different. And still, the contemporary music of whatever genre, except for, you know, contemporary art music, certainly isn't getting picked up by the opera house.
What about the argument, I mean, often comes up with these types of singers like we've been discussing, or this type of repertoire, that it helps to grow the audience for quote-unquote, you know, serious classical music, whatever you want to call it.
Well, it does.
You know, I don't see the evidence. I don't see the evidence for that. I think it's a totally different audience from what I can see I go to Europe.
I think it probably has the opposite effect. I think people start to think that opera is about, you know, 12-year-old girls singing famous tenor arias, and you know,
she was still pretty impressive when I saw. I mean, I couldn't do that when I was 12. So.
You know, it actually puts them off exploring legit opera, I think.
But they might stumble. I think the only way that they'll stumble on it is if it's if they were to walk into a music store, which doesn't really happen anymore, you know, because if they're constantly looking to be referred music by a some kind of algorithm on a computer database, you know, then, you know, it used to be if you walked into a music store, you would go up to maybe Il Divo, and then it would be next to the, it would sort of sag into the opera department, and then say, oh, what's that? And it would sort of, you might be drawn, but if you're just sitting at your computer, I think it's a lot more difficult nowadays to stumble upon a legitimate, you know, recording of Tosca.
Well, and
even one with Andrea Bocelli.
Yeah, and there's less and less opera on TV, at least in the English speaking world.
That is absolutely true.
So your chance of turning the TV on and seeing, you know, Flying Dutchman, which I remember.
American
doing
TV
at
has completely given up on opera.
Well, Canadian TV hasn't even had anything to give up on.
CBC has given up on opera.
It's also all on demand too, just like music is. I mean, I don't really watch regular television anymore.
So you're not going to hit it serendipitously like you might once have done.
Yeah.
Well, this is the same argument, you know, with the sort of demise of the radio station, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, that it's all niche, you know, radio stations now, and that you kind of go to what you like, but how do you discover what you like to begin with is always my question. I mean,
human interaction.
Yeah.
So I suppose that the answer to all of this is, I mean, maybe it is you have to have some kind of publicity machine behind, you know, I mean, Anna Netrebko's done pretty well with having, you know, a public kind of persona. People tend to know who she is. I mean, who knows
so?
If she's...
Do you think so?
I
mean, if you went outside the opera world, if you just rounded up 20 people on the street, on Front Street, how many do you think would have heard of Anna?
Maybe
Netrebko?
Not in Canada, in Europe.
That's different. That's different.
Because they have their publicity machine. Deutsche Grammophon has this publicity machine. They and the artists pay big bucks.
But it's also opera still outside of the UK. Opera's still kind of respectable. I mean, you know, heads of state, heads of government go to the opera, and people see them, and so on. And you know, it's just accepted as part of what people do.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, here. My guess is that Stephen Harper's spin people would say, don't be seen at the opera, Stephen, you'll be seen as elitist.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, he wouldn't, because he actually made a speech about how, I think that was about 2008, he made a speech about, well, ritzy galas.
Oh,
things
right,
like that.
Yeah.
I remember that. I don't think you would find him at the opera. and Margaret Atwood, I also see Margaret Atwood at the CUC.
Absolutely.
Right. Absolutely.
I mean, she's Canadian royalty. So.
That's right.
But, you know, talking about royalty, it's really interesting. I was watching the DVD of the Copenhagen Ring, the Royal Danish Opera one, and there's a half-hour interview on the Die Walküre DVD between the director, Kasper Holten, and the Queen of Denmark. Right,
wow.
In which she discourses intelligently and amusingly about her experience watching Wagner, listening to Wagner, and find the Queen of England and Canada doing that.
Now, recently, the architect of the Four Seasons Centre, which is the opera house that we love so much here in Toronto, was in the news again, Diamond Schmidt, because they had been commissioned by Valery Gergiev and I'm sure a lot of other people were involved, to build a new opera house in St. Petersburg, new Mariinsky Theater. And we've just, you know, it could have been unveiled now, and we're starting to see pictures of it. And a lot of us around here at CUC were like, wow, that looks familiar.
So it's three times the size.
Right, right. But what I thought was interesting were some of the reactions, that some of the early reactions to the building, and how they were, some of them were quite similar to what I was hearing when the opera house here was first unveiled, and sort of accusations that it looked like a shopping mall and things like this. But it seems to be this, people have, again, it's sort of like what we were just talking about, they have an image of what they want an opera house to look like. So if there's not a lot of like gold and red velvet, then some people get quite discombobulated. But did anyone look at any of the pictures? Or?
Yes, it's hard, kind of hard for us to comment because we haven't actually seen it. But I mean, I think that if you look at the context of what happened in St. Petersburg, is they had terrible overruns you know, the previous designer, mm-hmm. and they finally decided they couldn't afford it. Mm-hmm. So they find somebody who can build a functional, acoustically friendly opera house that, you know, so, and Jack Diamond proved that he did, like here with the Four Seasons Center.
Yeah.
You know, our opera house may not win any awards for architectural daring, mm-hmm. but it has great acoustics. It does what it's supposed to do.
That's right.
Yeah. I think that's right. I mean, compare it with that thing on Sydney Harbour that looks pretty spectacular, but has dreadful acoustics.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think it would have been great if in a world of unlimited money to build an opera house with those acoustics and, you know, fantastic landscaping and stuff on the lake or something, on the harbour. I mean, you know, that, like they did in Oslo.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that would have been wonderful, but it was never going to happen in Toronto.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, given a choice between great acoustics and looking pretty on a postcard.
Oh, it's true.
Yeah.
I mean,
I think we're so lucky to have a house that has such good acoustics.
Yeah.
And great sight lines too, for the most part.
You know, and the one here blends in a lot more with the architecture. I think people's probably their main problem is the continuity from the outside. I mean, if you look at the original theater, which is right next door, and then that one,
the Mariinsky.
So, yeah, Mariinsky is you know, beautiful
19th century
structure, you know, and this one is very utilitarian. As I mean, in comparison,
mm-hmm.
it's not to say that it isn't made of, you know, beautiful materials or anything like that. It's just, you know, it is very, you know, straight lines and things like that. So I can see why people might have an issue with it as far as how it looks from the street. But by itself, it's not that bad, I don't think.
No,
agree.
Except for that bizarre marketplace that they slapped on one side of it. I don't know if you saw the pictures.
Oh, I didn't see that one.
What is it, like an open?
It's something that
space?
They had to take down to put up the new building.
Oh,
so I think it's an old marketplace front. I don't know what century it's from, but it is very bizarre.
Oh. Well, one of the blogs that is one of the more regular contributors to the classical music scene here in Toronto is called Musical Toronto. And it's written by John Terodes, who also writes for the Toronto Star. And I just was sort of taken by a recent post of his, which I'm calling What's Happening with the Art Song Recital. He remarked on a couple things he'd been attending lately. Here in Toronto, we have a series of sort of up-and-coming, not so much up-and-coming, but young professional Canadian singers who a great enterprise by Roy Thompson Hall. The last recital is by mezzo-soprano Alison McCarty, who's sung a lot with a Canadian opera company. And what John remarked on was that, you know, there were only about 60 people there. I was at that recital that day, and I think that's probably about right. And then just even more recently, April 26th, this past Friday, a local presenter of many years of incredible series of concerts called the Albert Connection is winding down their enterprise, not for lack of people, I'll add, but they had some special concerts going on for the Britain anniversary, and John Terodes remarked that, you know, they couldn't sell out a 340-seat theater here in Toronto. So all I'm thinking about here is, what is happening with the Art Song Recital in Toronto? There's so many great singers who love this repertoire, work so hard on it, and yet the audience really does seem to be dwindling. So what's your opinion on the future of this? Is there hope? I hope so, because I love recitals.
You know, I think that recital is hard work on the part of the audience. There are no surtitles,
mm-hmm.
right? And you have to know the text, and it's usually with piano, it's not flashy arias with high C's. So people are just, it requires more work. And in this day and age, I mean, the people who are willing to put out the effort,
mm-hmm.
you know, to really appreciate this repertoire, I think they are few and far between.
I think that's a good point. I mean, I think there's also a lot going on. So, you know, I think there's a supply problem as well as a demand problem here. I mean, between, you know, free concerts at the Four Seasons Center at lunchtime and any number of recital and concert series across Toronto, you could go to a concert in Toronto pretty much every night of the week through the season. And I just don't know that there's enough of an audience to spread across that many that many events. I mean, especially when it's not like ultra high profile stuff. I mean, okay, so Alison McHardy is a very, very decent singer. I mean, I know they're speeding that for a minute, but she's not exactly international A-list.
She is singing internationally.
Yeah, but she's not Anna Netrebko.
But I think, well, the point
she is very accomplished, though.
Absolutely.
And so for people that do know the industry, I think
people who
that was probably surprising that there were only.
Yeah. But we had sort of a pre-conversation before you got here about this. I said, let's wait till the podcast. But one of the things we're saying that even with the big name singers, so the Anna Netrebko, I don't know, Nathan Guns, or some of the ones I remember coming here recently, the numbers dwindled so much for those people here in Toronto that they've kind of been shut out too now.
I feel like there's somewhat a bit of anarchy going on right now. I think the city, the classical scene sort of rediscovering itself, and there's a lot of interesting smaller groups popping up, and maybe a different generation of people are starting to take the reins. You know, Albra is finishing, but then there's the new Rosedale concert series coming up. I was at the Against the Grain production a couple months ago, and it was packed, and it was awesome. You know, like the energy in there was just really high, and what they did was really interesting and unusual. And I think, there are smaller organizations now that are producing things in art galleries and different spaces.
I was at Opera 5 last night.
Yeah, I'm going to that tomorrow. Oh, no, on Thursday. So there are things that are happening, and I think you just have to pick something that's unusual that will get that person to, you know, come home after work and go back out, you know, like that'll push them out the door.
Sort of a non-traditional venue, you know, a very adventurous kind of programming, like the Jana Check, you probably are talking about Against the Grain, as opposed to a singer that just stand there and doesn't say a word to the audience and just sing.
And why shouldn't there be, I feel like there should be translations in your, I mean, that's what we were, flogged about that in school. You know, you have a convert, you figure out what it means in English, and you put a translation next to it, because you have to help the audience.
But I can tell you, if it really is a fantastic, well-known singer and so on, Jonas Kaumann sold out Maison Symphonique and then in Quebec, the Grand Theatre. Both performances sold out. And he had never sung in Canada before. You know, so I wouldn't say that, you know, people don't come out. I think a lot also has to do with promotion. Sometimes there's no budget to promote. You know, the Canadian Voices, I don't think they have a big promotion budget.
It's definitely a hard.
And newspapers don't write articles on singers anymore.
But you know, I think he talked about is it something that's, I think that he mentioned whether or not now we're going to start having these Schubertiad kind of house music.
Right. Yeah.
Style
he was mentioning
concerts.
The Canadian Art Song Project, which just did a recital at the Four Seasons Center, but how that they're, you know, going back into people's living rooms, and that was part of the
which came from. So why not?
But in terms of dollars and cents, those are very hard.
That's hard.
Sledding.
But I think we do forget that, you know, a lot of that repertoire, that's where it was meant to be sung, or that when it was first produced, that's how it was performed. And we've kind of like inflated it into big concert halls, which aren't always suitable, 2,000 seat places like Royal Thompson Hall.
I mean, the whole reason that was going on was because there was that new middle class, the bourgeoisie, they were taking control of musical tastes. It was no longer just whatever the king liked. And so, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, if it does go back into people's houses, maybe they can still charge something at the door, and there will be this sort of new approach to it. I think it's really interesting, and I'm excited to see where it goes. I know it's not great for bottom line. If you are an organization that's trying to produce them, it's tough. But I think it's that would be really great and fun.
Yeah. You know, this Thursday, I'm going to this Women's Musical Club recital at Colonel Hall with Russell, Carolyn Moore, and James Ennis. And they, you know, like, they are like Aldeboro. They have a very loyal audience.
Yeah.
You know. But again, the demographic of these audiences are getting up there.
Yeah. So, well, that was the thing about Opera 5 last night. It was a relatively young audience. And as it has been at the Against the Grain things, as I recall, pretty mixed anyway.
Yeah.
Pretty mixed. So, Something's working there. I mean,
and there's a cross. There is. I was talking about crossover artists. You know, if you have, if you incorporate some dance into it, or bring some actors in from another part of the artistic community, it does broaden the tentacles of the classical vocal community, and then more people know about it and hear about it, and they'll go to maybe a dance show. And instead of being competitive and exclusive, it's a more all-embracing approach that I think is positive.
I'm happy to hear all this. I'm feeling so much more hopeful now. The last topic we're going to try and get through today is, it was recently announced. Now, I'm a recording sort of addict, I'll admit it right now. So this means something to me, maybe to no one else, I don't know. But EMI and Virgin Classics, certainly EMI is one of the, you know, the greatest recording companies of the, you know, 20th century, and has had an amazing roster of artists. Now, they, there's been all sorts going on. They were first bought out by Universal. They were for a little while under the Universal banner, and now it's been announced that they've actually been purchased by Warner, and that the Warner label is apparently going to create a new classical label under which EMI and Virgin will be distributed. And I'm just what interests me about this, I guess, is it's just more of this, I don't even know what you call it, everything's sort of being subsumed under one label. I mean, we've got now just Universal and Warner left, and maybe...
Sony, that's Sony.
Yeah, Sony does produce some stuff, but, you know, it'd be a shame if this sort of legendary company just sort of disappears. I'm not sure how they'll do it in the end. But
well, I think because of the crisis in the recording industry. But having said that, they are still willing to put out the big bucks to sign contracts. Do you know that, at least that's what I heard, just a week ago, Jonas Kaufmann is no longer a Universal artist and has been signed by Sony.
Oh.
Interesting.
I think there's a few big names that probably are still getting those kind of contracts.
Yeah.
But
Lang Lang,
you know,
is no longer with Universal, and he was signed by Sony.
Oh, okay.
Wow.
Yeah, that was some time ago, actually. Oh. And, you know, but when you think, you were saying that Warner has a new classical label, well, they had Erato.
Mm-hmm.
What happened to it? It died.
Yeah, it's not a good track record for
no,
any
terrible.
Labels. I mean, what EMI's been doing mostly the last few years is re-releasing old things, which has been great for some of us who didn't get those things the first time around, you know. But I wonder now how much new recording EMI will be doing, if any, or if it'll just be all their old catalog.
Live, yes, but studio,
no. It's too expensive.
Because I have a friend who works in the industry.
Okay.
And and so they're non-recording.
So I mean, an opera recording, you can do video to Blu-ray for $200,000-$250,000, right? Off a live performance. Do a studio recording with the same cast, it costs you upside of twice that.
Sometimes, if you're talking about big things like Valkyrie or something, seven figures.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
And you look at something like The Ring, the Christoph von Dohnányi Ring was never finished.
Yeah.
It was on Decca. They only made Rheingold and Valkyrie, and that was it.
Yeah.
They couldn't finish it.
Because you can go to
any
major opera house in the
Ring
cycle, video recording.
It was talked about, because there were some of the singers were singing in Toronto back then. And apparently, I think it's the Rheingold. They only sold 500 copies.
Wow.
Well, I must admit, I don't understand what the market for a modern audio-only recording of an opera would be. I mean, I kind of understand why we listen to the historical ones, because it's what we've got. But, I mean, opera is as much about what goes on stage as the sound. At least to me, it always has been. So why would I buy an audio recording, especially when it usually costs twice as much as a video recording of the same thing?
Mm-hmm.
And the video recording will probably have better sound.
Yeah.
I feel the same way. But you know, there are friends of mine that are music aficionados. They don't like to watch. They prefer to just listen.
I know there are people like that.
I'm in that camp.
I'm in the video camp.
But
it's really hard
to listen, I can stick the Blu-ray disc in the Blu-ray player and turn the TV off.
Now, I'm just curious, as an artist manager, do you have singer, I mean, what is the singer's point of view on recording now? It's just like we kind of have to do our own recordings if we want to do them?
Oh
or
my gosh, don't get me, okay.
Well, no, well, maybe in
no,
a nutshell,
no, I mean,
if you
I
don't
have,
mind talking about it a little
I
bit.
I have, for, I'll put it this way. It is to every artist's advantage to have a solid recording,
right,
or more. Okay, so if because of the international nature of the business, you want to have an excellent recording that you can send off to Amsterdam or Japan because you're sitting in your house in Toronto and you want to sing in those places.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the best thing for you? They want to hear a recording. Now, most that for concerts, they'll symphonies, they will hire off of a recording. They
mm-hmm.
have no problem. The opera industry is different. They always want to hear a live audition
mm-hmm.
or they want to see you perform something else or they just know you from working with you previously.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the thing is that really, as far as marketing goes, it is so much better to have a good recording, and I cannot tell you how difficult it is to get one because the singers themselves just don't have the funds to produce
yeah.
something
of a best good enough quality,
such
right?
a high quality.
Yeah.
I mean, and they do, and there are there. We I mean, we encourage people to apply for grants for those things to make recordings. But it's still so difficult. There are a lot of people that are, you know, want the same grant. So I mean, there's that challenge. But you know, I really wish that there was an easier. What do you call it? Just sort of. I wish that there were better. Agreement between the symphonies that play during the operas and the opera houses and so that we could come to some kind of agreement because it's better for everyone if these pieces are recorded live and then distributed to the public. I mean if you go on YouTube there are tons of videos from
mm-hmm.
from Europe and there is barely anything of any kind of professional level from North America, and I think that's such a
Well, you know why that is.
Yeah.
You know why that is. It's because the DVD, which is what's getting ripped for the YouTube recording,
mm-hmm.
Is a byproduct of a TV broadcast.
Yeah.
The DVD gets made when there's a TV channel willing to broadcast it. And when we've got the pathetic apology for a state broadcasting company that we've got in this country.
I think you should share your opinion on that.
Should we just add a caveat that is not everyone's opinion?
Right.
But they have scale back, way back,
yeah.
of classical recording. Now it doesn't
exist. They haven't recorded opera since the 1980s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I
yeah.
must say that I have.
And they were terrible recordings.
Yeah. I have encountered. There was a time I have encountered in Europe where you go to a leader recital or any kind of recital and then you purchase at the beginning of recital and when you leave, you take the disc with you.
Yeah.
Honestly. Have you
wow.
heard of that?
No.
No.
Yes.
That's amazing.
They had the engineer, everyone was there and they produce it very fast. They have the machinery.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe they... It's possible
it
that
be a
somebody
dress
sent
rehearsal
it to
or
you.
Something.
No.
It's live
no,
and it's
of
just
that
given
performance
to you.
That you just heard.
Oh my goodness.
That's
yes.
wow.
That's magical.
Yeah.
Literally.
Yeah.
Well, it just shows how things have evolved and will continue to do so, and I really don't know
like,
what the future of these big record companies will be, if anything.
You know, it would be nice if there was some kind of what do you call it, like development that was aimed at raising funds to make recording. I mean, I'm sure there is. Like, what you know,
yeah.
I don't know what's going on back in the back rooms of different companies, but to sort of to look at that as a benefit for everyone. And I know
yeah.
that with unions, it's difficult. It's,
yes.
I mean, it does come down to being able to afford to do these recordings, but it
mm-hmm.
is just something that I think has been overlooked, and it's just so vital to the health of the industry
mm-hmm.
to get
well,
that out
was,
there.
That was something that Peter Moore's foundation was doing a pretty good job
mm-hmm.
with in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
That's why he's listed as the philanthropist of the year in the
oh, yeah.
magazine thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
I have to say, French Canada seems to be doing better than English Canada when it comes to recording.
Well, because I think funds are...
Subsidies are
yeah,
yeah.
put
better.
Towards that, right?
Yeah. yeah.
Government funds.
Yeah.
yeah.
It's definitely true. I mean, I think there's a whole generation of younger French Canadian singers who have been documented in a way that people from the rest of Canada haven't been, and that's just
sure.
yeah, it's just
yeah,
where
so.
The money goes. But anyway, well, good. Thank you very much. That was a great podcast today. I want to thank you all for taking the time to come down. And last time we talked, it was freezing cold. Do you remember that morning? And now we finally got some spring here in Toronto, knock on wood. So thank you for coming. And just want to remind people that you can listen to these podcasts at coc.ca on COC Radio. You can also download them from our podcast page on the website and most importantly on iTunes, where we go up regularly. And please, haven't had too many, but we've had a few comments, and we know you're listening. Actually, the numbers have been really encouraging, so it's going up. So we're really happy about that. We welcome all your comments and suggestions. You can do that on Facebook when we put the posts up, and also on our website. So until next time, we'll see you then.